Descent through sound.
Descent through sound.
Descent through sound. Looking for media and its reflection.
Descent through sound.
Join us for general orientation every third Thursday, 12, 3, and 6 p.m.
3647 University, CKUT 90.3 FM.
Oh, they're very shrewd. I must say, they're really quite remarkable in their ability to use the media.
www.ckut.ca on the World Wide Web. News, interviews, and music featuring the voices of prisoners, their allies, and supporters. Tune in to the Prison Radio Show on the fourth Friday of every month between 11 a.m. and noon, and every second Thursday of the month between 5 and 6 p.m. To get involved in Prison Radio, or if you need to access past programs, email prison@ckut.ca.
Rehabilitation.
I wonder if you know what the word means. Do you? It comes from the Latin root habilis. The definition is to invest again with dignity. You consider that part of your job, Harvey, to give a man back the dignity he once had? Your only interest is in how he behaves. You'll conform to our ideas of how you should behave.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
You were a number, you weren't a name, you want to be a human. I wasn't Jim Crow, and hell, I was number 586.
Why do you do a warder's job?
It's a good job. Responsible job. Officers like myself trying to...
Scum.
We're only enforcing the law.
Oh, the law. The law. When they hang my husband, is that just...
Hi. You're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. This week, we're interviewing James. James is a prisoner living on parole and a member of the Toronto Prisoner Rights Project. In this interview, James talks about his experiences in grassroots organizing, life on parole, surviving trauma, and much more. He provides ways to support the Toronto Prisoner Rights Project as well, so be sure to listen in for those. Now, on with the show.
I came to the project looking for community support because I am also a prisoner. I'm serving a life sentence since my arrest at the age of 17 in 1989, and I've been on parole in the Toronto area for just over the last year and a half. And so in my search for, I guess, something meaningful and something that matched my what I have to give, I found this group, which is a grassroots organization that supports prisoners and parolees, people with lived experience, in so many different ways. I was just amazed when I first joined the group. I don't think I actually participated or said much for the first couple of months because they always have probably close to a dozen different projects on the go, whether it's fundraising for people. There's a current art auction going on our Instagram page that's probably done by the time this airs. But we also, we've raised about $200,000 so far to give to prisoners in a one-time $225 stipend so they can afford things like telephone costs, food, and for people getting out, hotel rooms, transportation, work clothes, sometimes legal support or family expenses. And it's not a large amount of money. And as a recipient of the stipend, I can say that the moral support that it gave, the idea that somebody was just sort of giving you this money with no strings attached to meet whatever your needs were, really meant a lot to me. And I know from feedback that we've gotten through the group from different guys inside, that it really means a lot. It's for people who go through the carceral experience most of that experience is losing things. You know, you lose contact with your family, your friends, you lose all of your personal items, anything that means anything to you. And you lose all of that time, and you lose a lot of dignity, and you lose a lot of your even mental capacity for people who are incarcerated for long periods of time, specifically those who spend time in solitary confinement. So to have an organization that is literally giving you tangible support really meant a lot for me. And as we know, 95% of the prisoners inside will return to the community. And so ideally, we want to make them better people before that happens. And
so it sounds like there's a lot of stuff happening with the Toronto Prisoner Rights Project. I'm wondering if you could walk us through the different projects.
Yeah, for sure. I guess one of the first projects that I got involved with was a citywide mural project. And we've been... we've joined together with local artists, and we're looking to paint four large-scale murals that will represent abolition. And so in the process of this project, we are connecting with the community, with people with lived experience, and we want to know their stories, and we're creating these dream forms for people to contribute ideas and their experiences that artists can then render in these large-scale murals. And so that's an ongoing project for the next about a year or so. Another project that I think is really important is our phone line, our prison phone line. We've got several phone lines in Maplehurst and Toronto South Detention Center so far. We may have one in East Detention as well, and there for prisoners to access resources, to call us if, you know, even if they just need someone to listen. Those can be very starkly depressing and degrading environments for people, and just having someone to talk to can sometimes help people to survive the experience. I think I mentioned already the fundraising, the Prisoner Emergency Support Fund. It was initially started to support prisoners through the added pressures of the pandemic. And over the last 2 years, we've raised over $200,000 that have been given out in $225 stipends, a small amount, but it does cover some of the costs for people like food, telephone costs, which are fairly high for the prison pay that people get. As well, for people reintegrating, it can afford them hotel rooms until they find suitable housing, transportation, work clothes, legal support. Sometimes there's family expenses. So even though it's not a lot of money, it is a real morale boost for prisoners who have gone through this carceral experience. You get used to losing things, having everything taken away from you, your family, your relationships in the community, not to mention all your personal effects, things that, you know, you get used to having around that kind of help remind you of who you are. And so to have somebody actually give something to you, no strings attached, even though, again, it's a small amount, it goes a long way as healthy and keep them in a positive frame of mind as much as we can so that they have a greater success when they return to the community. Because as we're seeing, there is an increase in prison populations that continues in Canada, despite the decreasing crime rate, which doesn't make sense except for the fact that these institutions are causing mental distress and problems for people when they do get out, like addictions, mental health, social awkwardness, and making it difficult for people to reintegrate. And that increases their risk of breaking conditions that are put on them, even if they're not reoffending. So we're seeing people going back and forth in this cycle still. And so the Toronto Prisoners' Rights Project is focused on breaking that cycle. And I think we all need to look at other ways to do that. But let's get back to some of the other projects that we're involved in. So we also have harms reduction education. We have a group that continuously gets information and provides information to our members and A lot of our members are in social work and are connected with community organizations that provide support for prisoners. And we also have things like mental health first aid training. So many of our members have gone through that. And from that, we've developed our own mental health first aid training module that's also available for new members and for prisoners as well. The group also does different webinar series on, as I said, harms reduction or, you know, any circumstances, I guess, that prisoners face, whether it's legal issues or relationship issues. We also talk about alternatives to the prison system in terms of abolition, as far as creating safer environments and safer conditions in the community so that people aren't pushed to the margins and kind of out of the mainstream where they end up, you know, often running afoul of the law because they're not having their needs met otherwise.
I was just wondering, I mean, it sounds like your group is doing like a lot of different types of projects and sort right. of thinking about things in this, like sort of thinking about abolition and alternatives to incarceration from sort of this holistic way, right? Of like people need support when they're inside, after they get out, people who are vulnerable need support so they don't end up in prison. So it's really neat to hear that a grassroots group has been able to think so sort of like holistically about these issues.
Yeah, I can say from my personal experience joining the group, you know, I've served most of the last 30 plus years incarcerated, 26 of those years incarcerated. And so I've been back and forth on paroles a few times. And this last time was very similar to the other times in that I felt very disconnected. Yeah, I felt very, it was very apparent that most people have built some sort of roots and they've developed relationships over a very long period of time. And that adds a sense of comfort to people in their lives. And prisoners don't have that if they've been inside for a long time. So there's a lot of anxiety attached to that. There's a lot of loneliness that can lead to depression.
What do you think helped you?
So I know when I came to the group, one of the things that was so welcoming to me was the kind of silent offering of space. The fact that I was welcome to be there. I wasn't overwhelmed with efforts to help or treat me or fix me. It was just a place where I could go. And like I say, when I first started, I didn't have much to say at all. I was just kind of overwhelmed by the pace of all these projects going on. And when I did speak, I remember getting very emotional because it was, I guess, because it did mean so much to me to be there, to be connected with these people who are actually doing things that are helpful, which was so different than living in a prison or in a jail where you are just simply warehoused and you're kind of expected to meet your own needs and you don't have opportunities to do that. There isn't adequate social opportunities, whether it's education or even, you know, meeting friends with common interests or engaging in leisure activities. It was very limited. And coming out to the world to all of these opportunities is very overwhelming in a good way. I think it's mm-hmm. easy for people to feel that kind of flood of support or flood of opportunity and equate it to the same anxieties that come with losing all that stuff. Mm. And that same feeling can push people into substance use, as it did to me for several releases. I had a real difficult time not using alcohol as a means of calming that anxiety. And as a consequence of testing positive a number of times, I would just get returned to prison. Mm-hmm. And then the cycle would just continue. And so the Prisoners' Rights Project has been a real safe, comfortable, no pressure place for me to go where I know they have an idea of where I'm coming from. Most of them are students, professors, workers in social justice and haven't served time. Some have, but that didn't seem to matter. the fact that they had the mindset to offer me that space. Again, it's hard to say it. And rather than judgment or, you know, just ignore it. And a lot of people are of the opinion, you know, you do your time, you get out and you kind of get over it and you get on with your life. And I've seen some people who are able to do that. And that hasn't been my experience. And I think the difficult way is a more common experience. I think coming out of those places with dysfunction and problems that maybe you had before you went in that didn't get addressed, and maybe new problems that you come out with, that's a more common experience. And the more we can be open to understanding that and giving people space to work through that. I mean, even the halfway house, which is kind of connected to the system, has been a real great support. The particular halfway house that I'm in, the staff have been, some of them have been around for 25, 30 years even, and it's a Salvation Army in Toronto. And they've just not pressured me to go back to work, which has resulted in my finding great meaningful work with the university as a research assistant, as well as being able to volunteer with local church, with other social justice groups like Looking at the Stars, which is an amazing organization that takes live professional musicians into prisons and long-term care homes to help. Well, it's a gift that they give to people, again, with no strings attached, and this beautiful to sit in these dark, dingy, lonely places and have these professional classical musicians come in and play this beautiful music is just such a contrast. And it just opened my mind up. And I you see and hear people talk about the concerts afterwards and how much of an impact it has on giving people sight that they didn't have before, giving mm-hmm. people imagination and the thoughts that, hey, you know, maybe this isn't really my life. Maybe there are other choices I can make. Maybe there is a different path for me. And that's a fantastic organization. Mm-hmm. So having these groups and, you know, as well as the social aspect of it, we sometimes, the Toronto Prisoners' Rights Project, we have these socials. Obviously, during COVID, we haven't been able to get together physically, but we do these online game nights and we have fun, you know, and that's another aspect of the correctional experience, the carceral experience. You know, you don't go there to have fun. You go there to be punished, and that's what happens when you're there. So it's really a contrast to have these grassroots organizations here as a platform. They've also connected me with yourself from CKUT and other journalists and students who are writing papers, who are interested in the experience and who are interested in helping to make positive changes, not just for the people who get incarcerated, but for the whole community. Because if we help the people getting incarcerated, ideally they come back and rejoin the community. That's what we want. I think we don't want to isolate them in the first place, which is what the correctional system does. We take the person, the whole person, and we completely remove them from community support. And we abandon them for, you know, months, sometimes years at a time. And then according to whatever they have done wrong, we assign a certain number. And when they've paid that number off in years, then we bring them back and we say, okay, now you're okay to be here. But there's a real gap there in that practice as far as missing out on what's happening with the people when you do that to people, when you socially isolate people mm-hmm. and you alienate people and you ostracize people for decades. And then when you bring them back into the community, it's hard to expect people to be invested in the community, to have care and concern for a community that has essentially abandoned them, regardless of the behavior. And I can say, at least for lifers like I am, my offense was a complete one-off. It was a tragic death, an attempted robbery of a Toronto businessman with two of my friends from high school. And one of my friends got carried away. And because I was part of this violent robbery and made the choice to participate in that, I was found culpable of first-degree murder because I was careless and I was reckless, whether or not, you know, what happened to this person. And I have never stopped regretting that. And that motivates me also to participate in these projects and to try and create space for people to get better, because I know for a fact that almost all of the people that end up in the circumstance that I did have some history of trauma, neglect, or abuse. Mm-hmm. And that's a fact. And in my case, I watched my brother drown when I was just 4 years old. And back in the 70s, there wasn't a great understanding of mental health. And so I didn't get any counseling until my teenage years, and I started acting up. And within a short span of about 8 months to a year, I went from joyriding in cars to this tragic offense. And that's the reality of most of the people that I've met in prison. They struggle with mental health issues. We know that childhood trauma is an underlying mental health issue. It's a physiological change to mm-hmm. people's brains that mm-hmm. sets them up for anxiety. It puts us in a permanent state of being afraid, of being overly cautious, of feeling threat. We are afraid that we're going to lose something. We have that sense all of the time. And when people are in that state of anxiety, it's not uncommon to try and take things in an almost frantic type of way. People are trying to reclaim that loss that they got. They have this feeling like they're falling back and they have to reach out and grab onto something. And people will often grab on to substance use. Some people have issues with violence. Some people have issues with theft or trying to replace that loss with material things. Some people get possessive in relationship. You know, this is all driven by these childhood issues that shaped people's brains in ways that, you know, we didn't really understand. And we're just now beginning to understand this mm-hmm. stuff. And mm-hmm. That's something that these groups understand. And I think we need to bring more of this science of psychology and trauma into our laws and into the sentencing piece of our laws so that we can sentence people to getting help rather than sentencing people to be warehoused where this trauma is just, you know, they're re-traumatized by, again, being disconnected by, you know, that was my experience. When I had this loss of my brother, it shattered my family emotionally, and we had already been a broken family, and, you know, this broke my parents' hearts.
Yeah, and I'm really grateful for you for sharing that and for bringing in your own personal experience as an example, because it's a vulnerable thing to do, and it's also really helpful for people who are listening, especially those that don't have lived experience with the prison system, to really hear that so many of the challenges that people go through start really early in their lives. And I'm curious if you would be comfortable talking a little bit more about the mental health programming that the Toronto Prisoner Rights Project has. You had mentioned having like webinars and modules and things like that. And I was wondering if you would be able to dive into that a bit.
Yeah, for sure. So we have a mental health, I guess it's called mental health services budget that we assign for mental health first aid training. And this was a project that began not too long ago, maybe 6-8 months ago. And we went and found ourselves a fantastic mental health social worker who was able to train, I think, about a dozen of us over the course of several days, which brought to light for me and probably a lot of others some of the myths about mental health. And it helped me to recognize some signs of people having mental health problems, people in mental health crisis, and also better ways to approach people with mental health problems. We've seen a real disconnect there in the community with policing as far as these mental health checks, that so many of them are ending in violence because it seems it's such a misunderstood thing. Like, people who attend these mental health calls, they see somebody who may be acting aggressively or being loud, and the people attending, naturally, they feel some sort of threat from that. But the reality is that almost all of these mental health cases, none of them are criminogenic in factor or are criminogenic in nature. Most mental health issues that people are dealing with, that people you see even on the street, that, you know, they're maybe unwashed and they're maybe yelling to themselves, these people are not dangerous. These people are acting in ways that are not normal. But that doesn't mean they're criminals. That doesn't mean they're violent. It just means that they have had experiences that have caused their personalities to evolve in this way. And rather than treating them like they are a threat or a danger, if we could open our minds and consider that they're seeing the world from a place that's threatening. And so when these police move in, that's just more of a threat on these people that are already primed to feel threatened. If they can give these people space, you know, these recent roundups of the parks and the homeless people, we saw some real ugly stuff here in Toronto a couple of weeks ago. I think it was Liberty Village. And these people are, you know, camped out in the park, and I don't think they're really threatening anyone. But for some reason, the authorities felt they needed to go in and kettle these people, I think is the term. And several people were arrested and several people were hurt. I think even officers were hurt. And the harm that came of this was not from people camping out in the park. It was from authorities moving in and trying to control this behavior that appears different than authorities have been trained to respond to. Yeah, there's a real need for better mental health understanding. And as just one of these projects, as I said, we're also taking the content from the course that we took and putting that into our own comprehensive training course for others in the group to learn from, and for other offenders. Yeah, I feel honored to be a part of this group. I would like to see, there's a couple of members that have lived experience, and personally, I'd like to see more people get involved in this type of advocacy that have previous experience, because it's so valuable and it fills in those gaps for the people who have the academic side of it. I'm finding it is very heavy work, and mm-hmm. it's very difficult. It's taxing, I think, as much as it is rewarding. Mm-hmm. And so I see a lot of people who have this lived experience. Some of them come in and they get started with the group, but it's difficult for people to sustain it because it does hit so close to home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to ask actually for you, because I think this is a thing that does happen, where sometimes it's really hard to do collective work about things that are also highly personal. And at the same time, those are the most important voices and experiences to uplift as people who have also lived experience. So I guess I'm wondering for you if you found any, if there's been anything that's helped you to find this sort of balance between being a person who has lived experience of the carceral system, a lot of it, and being involved in this sort of like collective project.
Yeah, from a personal standpoint, there's been a couple of key pieces. Writing has been a valuable tool for me, journaling. Initially, when I was arrested, I remember writing letters almost every day about what was going on in the moment. And I think that practice of writing things down is very therapeutic, and it purges what's happening. So it allows you to get it out and not hang on to it and not allow it to build up and become this kind of constant anxiety. So journaling has been a big piece. Exercise has been another one. I have an uncle passed away many years ago, even before I got in trouble, my Uncle Glenn, and he gave me my first weight bench, I think, when I was 12 years old. And I didn't use it much back then, but I did kind of get a start on it. And so when I wound up in being arrested, I was only 17. I was probably 145 pounds soaking wet, you know, cute kid. And here I am facing an adult sentence, going through a transfer hearing. And sure enough, I was transferred to the adult side of the prison, the jail. And so I thought, well, I better get in shape so I can defend myself. And that's how I really started working out. And then eventually I began to learn, in the process of learning how to work out, I began to learn about how valuable it is and how healthy it is to do regular exercise, not just for your body, but for your brain, for your hormone levels, for sleep. Exercise is key. And so that was something that I maintained consistently throughout my sentence. And even today, I mean, I'm almost 50 now and my body's a little bit beat up. I had a mild car accident a few years ago while on parole, and I was incurred a spinal cord injury, which forced me to change my weightlifting routine. And that was a bit of a struggle for me because I'd spent a lot of my life and my time working on that. I'd gotten certified in prison through correspondence. My father paid for a correspondence certification program that was recognized by the American College of Sports Medicine. And so I also went to correspondence course in nutrition and physiology through Waterloo. And so when I ended up getting out the first time, that's what I did, was personal fitness training. And then I had this accident and I kind of had to shift gears. But still today I practice yoga regularly, sometimes Tai Chi as well. And the more I read about and learn about trauma, yoga is a real big tool for coping with that and healing that even. So, and along with yoga, which I think is very similar to meditation, which is something I haven't done nearly as long, but has also been for several years now, probably almost 5 years, a fairly routine practice. Music has also probably been the most recent thing that I've discovered is also really healthy for the brain, particularly playing music helps to stimulate the prefrontal cortex of your brain. That's the part where you get your empathy and your executive function, your planning. It's the part that regulates the center of your brain or your brain stem. And your brain stem is where you get all these fight or flight anxiety hormone chemicals produced. So the science says that when you're traumatized as a kid, that brain stem at the center, that gets overstimulated. And if you don't get lots of hugs and lots of support and lots of love and lots of stability immediately following that, and you hang on to that trauma, that brain stem keeps and stays active. And that's how you, that's part of who you become in your future. And with exercise, reading and writing, yoga, music, these are all things that have been shown to reverse that effect. I know in a lot of the prisons in the States, they've had yoga programs going for years just for that fact. And they started one in the institution that I had left a couple of years ago. And so it's good to see these things happening. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think people are starting to understand this stuff more and it's starting to be integrated. So yeah, and I guess even above all of that, those are all great personal skills that work for me. But the most important thing is my relationships.
And I'm really grateful that you highlight sort of, you spoke really fluidly about experiences of trauma and sort of these like coping mechanisms, and also that these cause like actual physiological changes in our brain. Because I think for some folks, especially maybe people who are inside who have had traumatic experiences, maybe they have also not had access to understanding how intensely it affects the body, and that years later experiences of like anger and frustration can be rooted to traumatic experiences because the brain has not been able to relax. It hasn't been taught that in the way that people who don't experience intense trauma have sort of these brain relaxation abilities.
Exactly. And on top of that, because people are in this frame of fight or flight, because people are, it causes distrust, it causes disconnect, it causes them, even if you offer the opportunity for people to get well, they may not take it because they are not in a state where they're feeling like they're comfortable doing that. They're mm-hmm. still feeling in a state where they have to withdraw. They have to, it makes me think of this experiment with mice I read about recently, and they showed, they went into the neural networks in the mouse's brain where they could turn genes on and off. And the gene that was associated with this brainstem stuff, they would leave it normally, and they'd put the mouse into this room, and you'd see the mouse scurry along the walls, trying to sort of get away from the center of the room. And when they turned the gene off, the mouse went out and it would just kind of casually wander through the middle of the room. It was no longer worried about being attacked, I guess. It no longer had that sense of, you know, kind of pushing away or recoiling, which is a familiar feeling that I still have all the time. Like, for example, you know, I've been out for a year and a half. I'm living in a halfway house, and when I go through doorways, I'm often careful when I turn the handle because I don't want to make noise. Because I know if I make a noise, someone else will hear it, and the attention will be on me. And that there's a possibility someone will hear that and come towards me. Mm-hmm. It's like I don't want to alert anyone mm-hmm. to my presence. It's mm-hmm. like I just want to be as small and quiet and not be seen. And I understand this stuff, and I know what's going on. And, you know, I talked about relationships, and I stopped there for a second because I get emotional, and it's hard to express how painful that it is to experience that trauma as a child, and then later in life, to have that trauma reawakened through whether it's imprisonment, being separated by family and friends that way, or, you know, simply being in the community and being available and open to family. And so many years have passed since I saw a lot of my family, and I feel grateful that I've been able to reconnect with some of my family members. But, you know, there is a lot of time in my day and energy in my brain that goes to thinking about the relationships that I once had. Mm-hmm. Even though I had that trauma and it did impact my family, and, you know, I feel really fortunate that I had an extended family as well of grandparents and aunts and uncles and cousins. And even though I was in that state of trauma and I wasn't able to, I was a very quiet and painfully shy kid. And I usually wasn't able to have much of a conversation or talk like I am today. But later on in my life, when I had to do it to get better, it was my experience in that family with those relationships, watching my aunts and uncles and grandparents and cousins and their social interactions, you know, that they welcomed me too, but that I couldn't fully join. You know, I still, that's what I go to as my, that's what I learned, even though I couldn't do it at the time. It was, you know, later in life. And I'm so grateful for that. But I'm also really sad because there's been so much distance and disconnect forced upon us by this carceral system. And even today, mm-hmm. you know, it's a very long process for me to say, go and visit my uncle or my aunt, or like I have family, I'm in Toronto, I have family in London, and it would probably be several weeks, maybe even months, of community assessments and assessments for decision and travel permits and all of this bureaucracy before we're allowed to spend time together. And then even then, it's, you know, at this time on this day for this long, and phone in here from this place, and it's all very structured in order to support this idea of safety and idea of protection of the community. But I don't think anyone who knows me or my family would suggest that that's a necessity in our case, but that's how the system operates. And so, yeah, so there's a lot of barriers and opportunity as well that I continue to look for, and I continue to find even in the Toronto Prisoners' Rights Project. Again, Looking at the Stars is another group, And people in general, I find in the community are very, for the most part, very understanding. People one-on-one, even my parole officers and my caseworkers, I receive a lot of empathy and understanding as they know my case is, you know, my offense is over 30 years old, and yet I'm in a very similar circumstance living in a halfway house as someone who may have just reoffended last year, and now they're getting out into the community. Even though I haven't been involved in criminal activity all these years, I'll never be outside of this reality that really is oppressive, again, for the sake of protection or safety, at least ostensibly, that's the idea. And I mean, it's punitive as well, and that's a difficult reconciliation for me to make. How do I pay for what I did? How do I pay enough for being part of taking someone's life? There is no, you know, as long as I live, all I can do is try to contribute to making the world a better place, contrary to what I did, which, you know, was a horrible way to use my life. So can I, you know, can I do that without being under this state of punishment? Absolutely. Is it fair for me not to continue being punished until the end of my days? You know, I don't know if I'm the one to say that or not. So, you know, that's a difficult thing. To want to rejoin society, to want to be a citizen again, to want to have that full experience and give all of myself, ideally, but then to be kind of caught up in this punishment and this process, legal process, that makes that complicated.
Yeah, for sure. And as many people know who are listening, and maybe if you're listening and you don't know this, when you're given a life sentence in Canada, you live out that sentence until you die. Like, you will live on parole forever, unlike in the US, where a life sentence can be terminated after a certain date. And I think that that's a really important thing that maybe a lot of people forget about or don't know about Canada in general, in terms of its sentencing practices.
Yeah, it's very easy to be reincarcerated. As I said earlier, it's happened to me several times for breaching conditions, having developed a substance use problem or proclivity or desire. It's a huge challenge when you come out to the community and 80% of Canadians are enjoying alcohol mm-hmm. on a patio mm-hmm. and you've spent most of your life not really allowed to enjoy yourself or being discouraged from having fun. And then to get out into the community, and it's kind of one of the most common pastimes, and to be shut out of that part. Not that people can't have fun in other ways. We can. But the fact is that's very common practice. And I've also found it to be, you know, enjoyable, and doesn't, at least for me, it's never led to fighting or criminal activity, or it's led to, you know, having an early bedtime sometimes. That's about it.
I'm going to take a sharp left turn, just because we're sort of nearing the end of our time in terms of the interview length. And I just want to give you a little bit of space to talk about the art auction or the Prisoner Emergency Support Fund, or if people are listening and they want to support the Toronto Prisoner Rights Project.
Okay. Yeah, So the art auction is happening right now, last week, and this is our second art auction. And so what we do is we invite people to our website, the Toronto Prisoners Rights Project.org, and there you can email us with a photo and a description of any piece of art, any item really at all, or even service that you'd be willing to donate. And rather than send things to us and then us send them to the bidders, we just ask that you hang on to them, and then we have the auction, and then we have the donators send the item directly to the winning bidders. Yeah. So, and I mean, the money that we raise will go to the Prisoner Emergency Support Fund, which again, As I said earlier, we've raised over $200,000 that has all been donated to support prisoners, either with prison or jail expenses like telephones, food, or for reintegration costs like hotel rooms, transportation, work clothes. And so currently we have another, I think, 891 new applications for the fund from prisoners across Ontario. And so in order to fill this, we need to raise another $200,000. And so we're confident that we can do this, given that, you know, we've only been an organization for about the last 2 years, just over 2 years now. And so I think we're just getting started as far as raising money and helping prisoners. I see us doing a lot of great work in the future. And for those who would like to support us otherwise, on our page, again, torontoprisonersrights.org, we have a GoFundMe link, and we also have a Patreon that people can go, and monthly donors will get benefits like access to cool swag. And I think it's an amazing opportunity right now in the face of all of the rising social consciousness. I think it's this COVID situation has forced a lot of us to kind of look at what's important. And I spoke about relationships earlier, and, you know, whether it's family or neighbors or employers, employees, friends, these are our communities. And the more we can invest in each other and support each other, the better our communities will be, the stronger our communities will be. And there is no greater need than in these communities of Indigenous and Black that we know our prisons are way overrepresented with. So these are the people that are going to benefit the most, people that need it the most, people with mental health conditions, people who have been pushed to the margins and often don't have the same access that people who are financially wealthy have. And so if not for us, who else is going to look after these people? You know, we certainly don't want to leave these people by the wayside. There's two problems with that. One, it's not right. And two, doing that leaves people in this cycle. And this cycle of harm that our carceral system perpetuates. We keep arresting people and isolating them, and we keep growing these institutions, building more cages to put people in. And we need to stop that. We need to stop investing in these harm machines, these misery machines. That's all these prisons do, is they just cultivate misery. They separate people, they isolate them, they cause them mental health problems. We need to stop investing in that and continue to invest in real safety and real protection and making our community safer by bringing these people back into the fold, by offering these people safe, comfortable spaces to live and to play and to be healthy, and rather than discarding them and abandoning them and causing them to develop worse mental health issues, because that's not working.
Thank you so much, James. It's been such an interesting, really personal conversation with you. So thank you so much for sharing both your own lived experience and also now your sort of journey on parole, your experience with the Toronto Prisoner Rights Organization. It's just been so great. So thanks for making the time to come on to the Prisoner Radio Show. And I think a lot of people are really going to benefit from hearing everything you've shared.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks for listening. The next episode of Prison Radio Show will be on Tuesday, August 10th at 5 p.m., It'll be a special episode covering Prisoner Justice Day. If you'd like to get in touch with us, send an email to prison@ckut.ca, or you can send us mail at PRSCO, courtesy of CKUT 90.3 FM 3643.
647 University Street, Montreal, Quebec, Canada, postal code H3A2B3. Thanks for listening. Thank you.
The Prison Radio Show is a twice-monthly news show on CKUT. The show seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggles by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging ideas about what prisons are and who ends up inside. We are dedicated to programming that is directly collaborative with people who are currently incarcerated. With that in mind, we would like to let you know that we have a phone line for prisoners and their outside supporters. In fact, we have two phone lines. You can call us Collect from Bordeaux Prison and Riviera de Prairie Prison by calling 514-876-3748. We also have a number for non-collect calls. That number is 438-337-8423. Feel free to call that number and leave a message for us with news to share on the show or an audio message for your loved ones inside. Prison Radio Show est une émission radio avec des nouvelles pour les prisonnières et leurs alliés et familles. L'émission cherche à confronter l'invisibilité des prisons et la lutte des prisonnières en se concentrant sur les racines de l'incarcération, de la police et de la criminalisation. Nous sommes dédiés à des programmes qui collaborent directement avec des personnes actuellement incarcérées. Dans cet esprit, nous aimerions vous faire savoir qu'on a une ligne téléphonique pour les prisonnières et leurs amis et familles. Vous pouvez nous appeler Collect de la prison de Bordeaux et de la prison Rivière-des-Prairies en composant le numéro 514-876-3748. Encore une fois, c'est 514-876-3748 pour les appels Collect. On a aussi un numéro normal qui est 438-337-8423. N'hésitez pas à appeler ce numéro et à nous laisser un message avec des nouvelles à partager sur l'émission ou un message audio pour vos proches à l'intérieur. Thank you.
afternoon. You're tuned to Butcher T's Noontime Cuts, hitting every Friday from noon to 2, playing you a wide variety of music just to make your afternoon delight just right. So stay locked to CKT 90.3 FM.